I lived in St. Louis for a few years with an interim, and I stood at Fort Wood River, which is where they were stationed or where they were before they set out on their trip. It's in Illinois, across from St. Louis, near the mouth of the Missouri. And that it would take them, let me get it, 1 year, 6 months, and 1 day to get to the Pacific Ocean from St. Louis, traveling upriver the Missouri, portaging over the Rockies, the Grand Tetons, and then down the Columbia River to the Pacific Ocean. But just a few days after my visit to Fort Wood River, I stood in Fort Clatsop, which was the winter home for Lewis and Clark after they had made it to the Pacific. It took me only 7.5 hours to get there. A five and a half hour flight, which included 35 minutes in Denver layover, and then a 2 hour drive from Portland, Oregon to Fort Clatsop. That's change. That's how the world has changed in those 300 years. And I wonder what Lewis and Clark would think about it. Let me go back. How do I click back? There we go. I got it. So, you know, I wonder what Lewis and Clark would say about it as we do that. And so for some people, change is good until it happens. That is, some people simply don't like change. That are even more to the point, we know it's happening. If you look at this cartoon, it's a herd of buffalo running somewhere, and there's one here with his eyes talking to the other one, saying as if we all knew where we're going. That we know change is happening. It's moved us out of our comfort zone, but we don't know where it's headed, what it means for our lives. And so we simply try to avoid it, or we try to get out of it. But then there are other people who seem to appreciate change. That for them, as it says, the status quo is not much to crow about, and what can we do to change it? They know change is needed, or need to adapt to the change, or that they're able to adapt to the change more readily than others. And this is a cartoon that minister going into the pulpit, a spiritual crisis coming on. And we're going to come back to this when we talk about religion next Sunday. But he gets into the pulpit and he says he wants a sign, and there it is, and there's a sign, no parking. That there are people who look for change to happen. It's easier for them to go with the flow. They know there is no parking, that this is what we're about. Change is all around us. And so if you think about it, maybe you've seen those stress level tests. Where you have a list of things that have happened in your life that have to do with change. You've changed jobs. You've gotten married. You've gotten divorced. There's been a death. You've moved to a new city, to a new school. Your health has changed. All these changes, and the list goes on, and you add it all up, and it's stress. Change, whether it's good, whether you don't like it or like it, change is stressful. And how do we deal with it? We're changing every day, whether we like it or not, physically, emotionally, spiritually, that the world in which we live is never the same. I think I know this. We all know this. I get to experience it even more often than others as an interim pastor watching and working, living with the church as it changes to a new pastor. And that there's this trauma, the stress that goes with this. And what I hope to do over the next three Sundays is to explore change. Today, I want to look at it through the lens of the Renaissance and Renaissance art. And then next Sunday to talk about it, to see how it is in Scripture, the stories of change. We know it's there and what that means for us. And then the final Sunday to consider the challenges of change in our lives. Personally, in the world we're living in, culturally, physically, health-wise, all the sudden pieces of change. So I want to get started with the new Renaissance. Now, let me say, and I need to be very clear from the beginning, I am not an expert on religious on the Renaissance art. I almost failed paint by number class. So that's my experience of art. But I had the wonderful, wonderful opportunity, well, 9 years ago, right around now, in June, to attend a seminar in Florence, Italy. It was sponsored by Southern Methodist University Dispute Resolution Center. They have a master's program in conflict resolution or dispute resolution. And the leader of the seminar was a man named Richard Blackburn, who is the director of the Lombard Mennonite Peace Center out of Chicago, Illinois, or Lombard, Illinois. I had studied with Richard for conflict resolution, for family systems, for a few years. And this, I was given this opportunity to participate in this. I was able to audit the course or the program, where Richard brought his church conflict resolution process to these human resource professionals, social workers, others, to talk about conflict resolution. But we did it, it was in Florence. We met at the Villa La Pietra, right outside of Florence, and had a week's worth of looking at, Richard is he's a Mennonite minister, but by education, he is an art historian. So in the mornings, we would go to all the museums in Florence, and he would lead us through the museums. Say an experience beyond belief for my wife and I to and the way, let me just say, the Southern Methodists, the way they called the one, if someone came with you but did not participate in the class, they were known as a tagalong. So Kathy for that week was my tagalong. I like that. So we had this opportunity. This villa, and there are several other buildings on the ground, is now owned by New York University, and there are many conferences that are held there. So this is, and so everything that I'm about to say about Renaissance art, or to share with you that I learned, comes from Richard Blackburn of the Lombard Mennonite Peace Center. We had exercises. Here's a group. Here we are working on a class assignment. Is that not delightful? That's just one of the times we enjoyed together. I loved Florence, Italy. But the Renaissance itself, one of the most creative artistic revolutions in human history. Renaissance itself means rebirth. For its time, was a new normal. It expanded most of about 300 years from the 14th through the 17th century, which means it includes the Reformation. But for most scholars would agree that it began in Florence in the 14th century. It's the era of this time of moving out of the Middle Ages, between the Middle Ages and the modern era into the 1700s. Intellectually, just a growth spurt or something changed in terms of literature and science and art and religion and politics and education. A new time for the world. And this particular picture, just various theories, I want to show various theories have been proposed. Why Florence? There's no real consensus on that, but just there was a group or something happened there with the political structure and very clearly the patronage of the Medici family that provided for artists like Michelangelo and others to grow, to share their art. But in this particular picture, it's the confirmation of the rule of the Order of St. Francis, in which St. Francis is receiving the Order for the Franciscans. Here is the Pope, the artist Ghirlandaio is putting it in Florence in the Palazzo, but it actually happened in Rome. But what is of interest is here in the right-hand corner, there's the Lorenzo, yeah, Cosimo Medici, but this is Francesco Sassetti, who owned the Villa La Pietra, where we had our conference, that is put in there. And even though the Medici was not part of that picture in Rome, or what really happened in Rome, because he was paying for it, he got to be in the picture for what's going on. That says something about it. But where did it really begin? How did it begin? That most art, most scholar would say that it began in the 13th century with the writings of Dante and Petrarch, as well as some artists. But some would argue that it really began, a date is with the competition for the doors of the baptistery in Florence. Here's the baptistery, and these are the doors, the gates of paradise, as Michelangelo eventually called them. But it was a competition, and two artists, Ghiberti and Brunelleschi, competed for this commission to develop these doors with pictures from the Old and New Testament. On the left is Ghiberti, on the right is Brunelleschi. Now, Ghiberti won, and what we were told is that one of the reasons Brunelleschi lost is this person right here who is outside the frame. This is the sacrifice of Isaac, and you can see him on the table. Brunelleschi had so many characters in here, but he went outside the frame and therefore he lost it. And this was in 1401. And from that time on, Ghiberti and Brunelleschi had a severe competitors in all that they did. But Ghiberti went on, Michelangelo called these the gates of paradise, as to how it changed the world. This man, as we move into it, is Giorgio Vasari. And I bring him in because he is the first, to use the word Renaissance in print. And he was writing in the 17th century, or in the 16th century, and he wrote a book entitled Lives of the Most Excellent Painters, Sculptors, and Architects. And he goes through and gives a biography of these artists of the Renaissance, very much a public relations piece, stories that are not necessarily true, but good public relations that really lifted up the artists of Florence for all of them. And he was the one that began to say that the art of the Middle Ages was basically rubbish, is what he called it. And that what was happening in Florence was a rebirth of the classical Roman art, or the Roman style. He promoted this polarizing view, setting up conflict between old and new with change. That this was change for the better. As he put this together, he is sort of the one who set out what we look at when we think about Renaissance and what happened. And this is the beginning of it, if you will. These two icons. The man Cimabue in the 13th century. Is one who began, as is noted, to take the first step moving toward a new style of painting. I know it's difficult to see, but there is a sense of perspective. It's not just flat pictures here. And there is a drape where you can somewhat tell that there is a person underneath the robe. And that might not seem much, but in the world of art, as I was told, this was a major step in painting. But then on the right is a painting by Giotto, again of the Madonna and Child. And that what is here is that if you notice, there is even, and I know you cannot see it, but there's even more of a developed person underneath this whole drawing of the Madonna, as opposed to what some would call just drapery over the knees here. This is an actual dress, actual piece, that there is a real person underneath here, that says it has form and weight. You can see this, that there's something there. And so again, I'm not the art historian. This is, I'm sharing with you what I've been told, that they are three-dimensional. It's not just a two-dimensional piece on a wall board. And then what Vasari said is that the Renaissance was a revival of classic antiquity, or a rebirth. One of the best ways to see this is through the Pantheon compared to the Duomo in Florence. This is over the cathedral. Now, no one really knows who built or what architects built the Pantheon. If you've ever been there and gone inside, there seems to be no support. How does this stand up? And what Vasari is saying is that what's happening in Florence is that the Florentine artists are able to recapture that and moving the world out of the darkness or the dark ages of the Middle Ages. And this is back to Brunelleschi and Ghiberti, it's a fun story. That again, there was a competition to put a dome on the cathedral in Florence. And not only for that, there was a competition that Florence was competing with Milan and Siena to have a bigger, better cathedral. And so there was a competition. And Brunelleschi had gone to Rome, had studied the Pantheon, spent a great deal of time looking at whatever records he could find for constructing this. And again, remember, he lost to Ghiberto to the doors. They to say that they did not like each other is a mild statement. There was utter contempt one for the other. But they were goldsmiths, and then Brunelleschi being the architect. Brunelleschi won the competition and received the commission. However, and Cosimo de' Medici supported Brunelleschi. He was the one giving some money. But those who had sponsored the competition or were judges made Ghiberto a co-chair, if you will, of this, to receive a salary equal to Brunelleschi's, and that neither ever really did receive the money. But Brunelleschi was the one who was going to get, well, what happened was that Brunelleschi got started, Ghiberto came on as the co-chair, and one day Brunelleschi called in sick. He says, I'm not going to be there. And let Ghiberto continue on with the work. Well, this went on for several days and nothing happened. And finally, Ghiberto said, I can't do it. And he left the commission, left the work. And Brunelleschi in 1423 became back in charge. There was the rivalry that spurred on the change within the Renaissance. You can see it. There was all sorts of Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo and Raphael. There's a story of Michelangelo while he was painting the Sistine Chapel. Raphael was painting the Pope's quarters, and the Pope, either the Pope told Raphael to go in and look at what Michelangelo was doing, or Raphael snuck into the Sistine Chapel to see what Michelangelo was doing, and it upset him. That is what we were told, that he saw how great Michelangelo was. But again, it spurred him on to paint the Pope's quarters with his pieces. The picture of Peter is amazing in the Sistine in the Pope's quarters just before you go into the Sistine Chapel. But so there was all this rivalry. What is going on with this return to classical, to a return to as I noted way back with Giotto, with a sense of naturalism in art. All of this spurred on by the real world, that, if you will, a definition of art is that it captures an image of reality in the eyes of the artist. And the artist were capturing or recapturing a sense of what had started, I believe this, with St. Francis of Assisi, who began to understand God for the whole world, not just the church. That at the time, within the church, the church was within the walls of whatever sanctuary it was, and St. Francis began to see that God, I'm looking at this last one, through our sister Mother Earth, who feeds us. If you go through all of this, all your creatures, brother, son, sister Earth, the understanding of God being part of and present in the whole world, and not just within those walls of a sanctuary, overseen by the priest speaking. And again, remember that at the time, the priests were the only ones who could read scripture. The Reformation and another part of the Renaissance, I think, that comes up with change is that sense, when the printing press, when people began to read, where books were published, that moved forward with everyone being able to relate to or related to with God. And this is that St. Francis' theology made Christ more accessible to human beings. Again, you go back to a Byzantine Middle Age picture, a very flat picture of Jesus that has no sense of reality, or at least the way we see it with ours. And here is Raphael in the early 16th century, in the 1500s, with the blessing of Christ, a true human figure, something very, very real. This is a change. St. Francis brought not only that his theology that brought it to art, but in terms of how people related to one another. St. Francis himself, who the story is, at one time he was walking along and just stripped down and gave his clothes to the poor. He was willing to touch the unclean, beginning to truly understand and follow in Jesus' way of relating to other human beings. That this new normal, again, speaking to what's going on, this is a picture of the baptism of Christ by Verrocchio, who was Leonardo da Vinci's teacher. And the story is, and it doesn't show, I don't know if it shows this well, but again, how things are changed. Verrocchio was a wonderful artist, but this particular cherub or child was painted by da Vinci. And it was the last piece to go in there, as we were told, as I understood. And the story is, or the legend is, that when Verrocchio came in to the studio and saw what Leonardo da Vinci had painted, this picture of a child compared to this, he threw down his brushes and never painted again, because da Vinci had brought something very new to the world, something that was able to capture emotion, that was able to capture a person with paint, something, a new normal. Again, something, a change had happened. Here's another way of looking at a new normal. This is the Last Judgment as painted by Michelangelo. It's on the back wall, the altar wall of the Sistine Chapel. that and it took 4 years to complete, completed in 1541. And he started working on this 30 years after he had done the Sistine Chapel ceiling. What is different here, and it's hard to see, but in terms of the change, a new normal that was being presented here is that the whole piece of the Last Judgment centers around Christ, rather than what had been a tiered understanding of heaven, earth, and hell, if you will. Starting at the top, there's heaven usually, and then there's a picture of earth and the judgment, and then hell at the bottom, a three-story worldview. What Michelangelo did, and we don't know whether he was told this is what you need to do, or whether he simply understood in his own faith, however that may have been, the centrality of Jesus Christ. But this was something very, very new. And what we do know too is that Pope Clement, who's the one who was the Pope at the time, had been studying. Again, remember this, there's so much of following timelines with all of this in the Renaissance, that Pope Clement was studying the work of Copernicus, which said that the world revolved around the sun, or the earth revolved around the sun. That was heresy for so many. Remember what happened to Galileo, that in some ways, did Michelangelo say this to do this, or did Pope Clement say that our faith revolves in turn, looking at it very clearly, revolves around Jesus Christ? Again, going back to the work of St. Francis, of focusing on making Christ more accessible to us as humans. So this is a shift in theology done through art. Now, some people don't like change. Change is not always easy, and I find this is just fun. The Pope's master of ceremonies, Biagio di Cesena, said he didn't like what Michelangelo was doing, that in so sacred a place, and you've got to understand, in the Sistine Chapel, that Michelangelo was depicting all these nude figures and exposing themselves to the world. There's even one I didn't put in here. There's a picture of God's backside, which is known as the mooning by God to the world. But in this particular, what this person, this aide, top assistant to the Pope said, is that it really should be not a play, not art in a public chat in the Pope's chapel, but it should be in the public baths and taverns. In other words, it was obscene. So what Michelangelo did, he worked, this person right here has is the face of Minos, who is the judge of the underworld, donkey ears, and who has a snake covering his privates, as not always in the other parts of the picture. And so it's said that when Cesena complained to the Pope about him being this person in the painting, the Pope joked back that his jurisdiction did not extend to hell, and so the portrait would have to remain. That's funny. 24 years later, again, there's always a response, reaction to change. 24 years later, the Council of Trent condemned nudity in religious art. So somebody came in, the artist Volterra came in and painted breeches or coverings over all the nudes within the Sistine Chapel or within the Last Judgment. Change has its challenges of whether people accept it or not. Something happened within the Renaissance, that this blossoming of art and science and literature, again, we could go on and on of Leonardo da Vinci. We could spend a whole day simply talking about what he did. in terms of changing the world with his sense of where the world was and what he's meant to the world. It was one of the most creative, artistic revolutions in human history, an awakening and rebirth. And I do want to put a piece in here, understanding this is European history. We have not said anything, and it's not out of rejecting. It's simply we're looking at European history of what was going on in the Far East. That is a whole nother world, also in the continent of Africa. We are not neglecting those cultures. Please understand that. This is simply looking at European history and as it has moved through our world in terms of the Reformation. And I bring to you this sense of the Renaissance because the world continues to be shifting under our feet every minute. As I said, just looking at the challenges from Lewis and Clark to our day, I think of my grandfather born in the late 1880s, who saw automobiles, airplanes, television, phones, space flight. He died in 1982. All that happened just within his life, all that is happening within our own world. The world is shifting so much in ways that are disorienting, upsetting, but I would argue potentially towards some sort of positive fundamental change in a way we've never seen before. That are we in that? That scripture says it this way, that unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Part of change is understanding what is it that we are giving up. And there are things that we don't want to give up. I would say you can go back and look at the Renaissance in that way, but in our own world. What is it, though, we're gaining? What is happening in this shift with going on? And this is where I want to conclude that given the increasing polarization and incivility throughout our world, even in churches, I believe, and this comes from Richard Blackburn, our studying under him and what he's meant in my life in terms of looking at change, the world is in need of a creative, redemptive revolution of equal magnitude and impact as the Renaissance. That Socrates himself said, the secret of change is to focus your energy not on fighting the old, but on building the new. Change is inevitable. We see it in our daily lives. We see it in the mirror. I just did a slideshow for my wife for our 44th anniversary that goes back to when we first started dating. And looking at those old pictures, I wondered, what happened to that guy? Where is he? I think my wife, she's as beautiful as she's ever been, but that guy was young and thin and looked really good. What happened? And so change is inevitable. And for some, change is difficult, that we fear and we resist this as humans sometimes. But I think if we can begin to celebrate the stories of change in our own lives, our own awakening, our own transformation, the rebirth, if you will, that we can then, because we need to learn, and this is to color outside the lines. And next week I want to pick up and look at scripture, beginning with creation, of what's going on that helps us learn about this God who says, I make all things new, from the beginning to the end. And I'll end here, and this is where I'm going to begin next week. When you take the Bible, and as I've said in another place, I'm not one to start in Genesis and read all the way to Revelation. But when you look at Genesis at the beginning, God is make, when God began to create the heavens and the earth, something new. And then you look at the book of Revelation. The book ends, the Bible ends by God saying, I make all things new. And so the beginning and the end match. I think that's part of what we have to understand and look at this sense of a world that is disorienting, that we need to find a new way. And what do we know about, as I say, color outside the lines, to look at this world as it's changing. I think that's what was happening in the Renaissance, that they colored outside the lines. And said,
Bruce.
Dave Hilty, just unmute you in the corner of the picture.
Yeah. I'm trying to get everybody in here. It's just, something's gone kabadoody.
Well, no, when somebody disappears, it could be that their Wi-Fi.
I just unmuted myself.
Very good.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. I got a lot of people.
Oh, all right.
Okay. I've got some black screens. I see here. Great. Here's to you.
We had a power blip.
Pardon?
We had a power blip.
Okay. Oh. I hope that made some sense, but that's just getting started into understanding Renaissance or looking at it and say to bring it into our world of this creative revolution of looking at humanity. That's what I, part of what I got out of there, out of the seminar, of what these men, and they were all men, as far as we know, who brought the world into a new way, and gave way for us as Christians, if you will, into the Reformation. I find that an amazing piece of how so many things came together. In this time period, and again, it was not just one year, but over a couple of centuries, how the world began to change.
Bruce, what I found interesting about your topic, we think of today as change being very rapid, almost mind-blowing to some people, and I think one of your points is this has been going on for centuries. And you just gave us an example back when all this was happening.
And that's part of my own studies of looking at change. We personalize it and bring it down to our world. But when we understand what was happening, we can go back to Lewis and Clark and what that meant for the world or for our country. And for better or worse, I mean, good and bad. There were some bad things that happened with that change. And I think we have to acknowledge some of that. So all of these pieces, that change is simply part of our world. And as I want to look as we move forward, what does it mean? What does it mean to us? How do we move with that change? That from a cultural piece, I think we're experiencing it right now. As I'm going to say in about 15 minutes. With the service, I've been experiencing this all my life in terms of the cultural, racial issues that are going on in our world. Sometimes very aware of them, sometimes simply moving past it and not acknowledging it. So, and then just as I said, I made light of the physical changes we all experience. This church itself, and we'll deal with some of that in the last segment, the changes that this church has experienced within the last 2 years. Unbelievable.
Bruce.
Yes.
I've got a question for you. is are you going to bring Martin Luther and the Reformation into this? Because I just finished reading a book about him, and talk about change.
that goes to Reformation for Martin Luther and for John Calvin, for the reformers, and that also within the Catholic Church. Since you've just read the book, I'll let you just go in and take it next week, and I'll stay home. Did I hear that?
You won't speak up again.
Yeah. I think we'll talk about that when we look at Scripture, of what, and it's a way of looking at it, of understanding Scripture, that how Martin Luther saw it and what happened there.
Right.
So for have we, what does it mean for us today?
So Bruce, I have a question for you. You probably don't get this question ever, but I hear lots of people asking, when are we going to get back to normal?
And, I told you.
You know, at the same time, I'm involved in a lot of stuff, and I think we all are, where large groups of people get together and go to national meetings or international meetings. And it's kind of interesting watching people come to terms with the idea that that's just not going to return anytime soon.
It's a question, and we haven't, this, what does normal mean? I'll answer your question, but I think that's part of what we see when I'm thinking of a new normal, and I want to approach it in a different way next Sunday. But normal does not mean of going back to the way it was, that there is no way to go back to how it was. Even in normal circumstances, in ordinary circumstances, we never go back to yesterday. As far as, and I think most people, if you're talking about in-person worship, in-person seminars, some things like that, Louise speaks about it today in her announcement. We are working on that as hard as we can, with all the pieces technologically that have to be in place, safety that is primary, the safety and well-being of the congregation, taking that into consideration. And simply how we do whatever we're going to do, which is not going to be the same. I just say one, when we do gather an in-person worship, you and Ted, you and Sarah, you are not going to necessarily be able to sit down to my left on the north side.
Well, that's a big problem.
I know that's, and I think that we try, I'll try to, but that's just not going to happen. Because of how we're going to move forward with our own being able to gather safely. But we are working, we're trying to get pieces put together so that we can continue to provide worship, at least, you know, for worship to everyone, not just those that are in person, but we've had so many through technology online. And we cannot forget or exclude those who do not feel comfortable, who are not able to return to being in person. So that's does that answer your question? When will we get to normal? Is today. Now, what normal is tomorrow, we're looking at. We'll check on that.
Hey, Bruce, yeah. I think the context for this is, you said some people don't like change. There's a lot of studies that say that's most people don't like change, and that number is in the vicinity of 90%.
I agree. I generalize down. Most people don't. But there is the change that is just so gradual. And we can talk about that again later on, and this is for the last part. There's a sense of continual change. As I say, I grow older. It's just part of what's happening. The church changes. We change officers. It's that sense of continuous change. It's when we have this rupture, the discontinuity between here and now, and some of that is, in a personal way, is a death, where it's just, I'm not ready for it, a lost job. I think we've seen it with COVID-19. It's hard for us to deal with a change so sudden in that way. That's very, very difficult. And that's true for us as humans. So there are two pieces to that, how things change.
One aspect of it, Bruce, may be who or what drives the change.
Yeah.
You know, when we initiate it, we may think about it one way. When it's imposed on us, we may think about it a little differently.
I think, Bob, you're right. And I think we as especially, and I would argue in this nation where we are accustomed, I want to do it my way. Do not tell me what I have to do. As soon as you put a barrier up, somebody's going to be there to tear it down. That's part of it. So I understand that. I've in prior life as a child, as a teenager, I helped my grandfather herd cattle. When we'd bring the cattle in to work in the spring and the fall and we'd drive them to the chutes, there was always one cow or one bull that was going to try to break through that doggone fence. And I got a story about a bull who did that. So, you know, we don't like it. We don't like to be moved in. Don't tell me what I have to do. That's part and parcel of who we are as Americans, I think.
That's why people don't wear masks.
Yeah, that's a whole nother piece to that. But I think when we get into at the end of the time, you know, the last of dealing with the challenges of change for us as a within our faith is changing within ourselves. How do we do this? What and so next week to look at the pieces of how scripture, I think, gives us a way to look at it. We're going to talk about the Psalms, how others, you know, moving through the scripture changes. It's all about the change. We can start from, you know, Noah with the ark and talk about being in a storm. And I've always thought about his daughters-in-law. How did they deal with their mother-in-law for 40 days in that ark? I mean, that's just, I mean, I know how that works. So the family dynamics with that, but all the way through, even to the disciples, and especially we'll look at Peter as he had the vision to go to Cornelius the Gentile and what that meant, what was happening. So the Bible is full of stories like that. So I hope this was enjoyable, not trying to give all the answers, but it gives a perspective into looking at a creative way of change and what's happening.
So Bruce, I notice you're recording this. Ted, are you going to put this online on the website? No, good.
Yeah. And it's, we got about 5 minutes till worship starts, which is pretty good for.
You got to run over to the sanctuary.
Yeah, right.
Thank you so much, Bruce, and thanks to everybody who got out and got up and tuned in. This is a new adventure.
All right.
Thank y'all so much. I appreciate you. It was good to see you.
Good to see you.
Well
done. Bye-bye.
Bye.